Okay, welcome to the last lecture. I thought that we would take a look at the timetable or the groups for the group work. So we have 10 groups now, ranging from 2 students to 4 students. So all of you are here now, and I thought the topics from 1 to 5 would present on the first seminar day, if this is suitable for you, and topics 6 to 10 will present on the second seminar day. If you find that you have something overlapping, please let me know so I can still change the times of your presentations. And keep in mind the given time you have. So for 2 students, we have 10 minutes, and if you have 4 students, you have 20 minutes to present, and then some questions afterwards. But the time is quite tight for five presentations, so we will try to keep it in the time schedule, so we will have time to ask a few questions also. Yeah. And then the home exams have been evaluated. I don't think you still have the points at Moodle, but I think we can have them during today in Moodle, so you can check your points. And most of you have passed the home exam. So good news on that. I actually had a small mistake in the how I was giving the information about the sample in the home exam, because I had 0.5 grams diluted into 50 milliliters, and the concentrations couldn't have been realistic in that case. So I should have had 5 grams into 50 milliliters. So some of you noticed that, but if you didn't, don't worry, I didn't either. So, but it doesn't make if you took the concentrations given in the exam, that's fine. So it was just about how much of the sample was diluted that was the problem, but I will fix it for the next year. Thank you for the person who who noticed this. Yeah, but then we can take a look at today's topic. So we will check out ICP-MS. Little bit about the practicalities of ICP-MS. How do we operate this kind of instrument? And just to remind you, what is ICP-MS and what is ICP-OS? So we have these two instruments. What are the differences between those? So for the ICP-OS, the plasma is an excitation source because we analyze emissions. And for ICP-MS, it's an ionization source. So we analyze ions. And with ICP-OS, we are interested in the wavelength. So that's how we identify each element. And with ICP-MS, this is the mass to charge ratio, which we identify the element with. Linear range, a little bit higher in the ICP-MS. Detection limits are lower with ICP-MS, so to the nanograms per liter range, and even below if you have high purity in your laboratories. It depends on the purity actually, rather than the capability of the instrument, but I will come back to this later on in the slides. The spectra with ICP-OS is very complex because we have the different emission lines, different emissions happening possible for each element, so it's very complex spectra. But for the ICP-MS, we only see the isotopes that are present for each element, so it's quite simple compared to each other. Common interferences, since ICP-OS has a complex spectra, the spectral interferences are the most common ones. For ICP-MS, we might have isobaric interferences, so two elements having the same isotope, they overlap, and molecular interferences, so maybe we have some molecule, carbon oxide, something like this happening in the plasma. So that can interfere with our analysis. Then I talked about robustness considering ICP-OS. Maybe some of you remember that if we have a sample that the plasma is robust, if it tolerates changes in the sample matrix, so it's not easily affected by small changes in temperature, in acid concentration, or something like this. So in ICP-OS, we check the magnesium, iron, and atomic line ratio. So this is the ionic and the atomic line ratio of magnesium, which should be above 8. In ICP-MS, we look at cerium oxide to cerium ratio, actually, and this should be less than 2%. So this is considering how much oxides we are producing in the plasma. So as we want oxides as little as possible, so this is about how much oxides do we have, and we try to minimize this ratio in ICP-MS. Then about the isotopes, with ICP-MS we can do isotope analysis, but with ICP-OS we cannot. So those are the major differences between the two techniques. Then some practical issues with ICP-MS analysis. I have put in a figure showing some colored samples. I wouldn't analyze these with ICP-MS as they are. So ICP-MS is quite sensitive to getting dirt. So you can analyze these with ICP-OS straight, no problem, so no dilution needed. But if you went into ICP-MS with these kinds of samples, you would dirty up the instrument quite easily. So these contain, I would say, a lot of copper, as you can see from the color, maybe nickel. Nickel also in those samples. And we have limits for the total dissolved solids. So this should be below 0.2%. So 1 gram of sample should be dissolved in 100 milliliters, equals to 1% of TDS. And this is too much for ICP-MS, so we need to get it below 0.2%. So this is our maximum limit. And this is for our instrument. So this varies by laboratory. So you can find different laboratories having this limit from 0.1 to 0.5, could be even. But this is what we have been thought in our when we did some training for our instrument. So this is what we use. Then acidity limits. Hydrochloric acid is the most corrosive of the acids, maybe you remember. So for that we have, it should be less than 3%. If you have other kinds of cones, so the platinum cones can tolerate more hydrochloric acid, but we have nickel cones, they are less expensive. So the basic cones tolerate 3% HCl. Usually we use 1 to 2% acid background in our samples and calibrations, and the nitric acid is the most commonly used. So we try to use that if we can. Then organic solvent also has a limit, and actually it's like a carbon limit of 5%. So because this introduces carbon into our system and it gets stuck into our cones. If you remember, after the plasma, we have the cones which transfer the ion beam into the vacuum, so the cones have a very, very small orifice, and that gets blocked very easily. We have high organic solvent content, so that's why the 5% limit. Then transition group elements should not be put into the instrument with concentrations above 10 milligrams per liter, even if you're not analyzing. So even if you have them as matrix elements. So basically these guys over here. So if you have high concentration of copper, as I have here, the concentration should be less than 10 milligrams per liter, not to dirty up your instrument. For iron, I would say we have made an exception of iron because we have lots of samples which have high iron content. So for iron, we have, because we couldn't analyze our samples if we were so strict with the 10 milligrams per liter. So for iron, we have, I think, 50 milligrams per liter or even up to 100 milligrams per liter we have analyzed samples. But this is a good maximum limit, so below that you should be safe. And that's because maybe you think, okay, well, it gets you wash and so you will get it out of the system. But ICP-MS is a system like it will get stuck somewhere there, and it will, if you have high concentration of that element, you will see it for maybe months, even months more. So that's why we are very strict on this. Then we use internal standard always for correcting the signal drift. So if we have a long run, the signal starts to drop for each and every analyte, and we correct it using an internal standard. And the internal standard should have a similar mass to our analyte, and in ideal cases, even the ionization energy should be similar of the internal standard compared to our analyte. And in some cases, if we have a whole lot of elements as analytes, we can do that. We have maybe two internal standards, which the mass range is quite wide. So we will use a lower mass internal standard for these guys, which have the lower mass, and the higher mass analytes will have a higher mass internal standard also. So we can divide these into batches, so to speak. And it's not very advisable if you have a wide analyte mass range to use only one internal standard, because this drift depends on the mass of the analytes. The degree of the drift will depend on the mass of the analyte. Yeah, and the matrix matching, so it's even more important than with ICP-OS. So we have the calibration standards and samples, and they have the same acid background, same reagent background. Because even small differences in this will cause bias into your analysis. So this affects the signal. We have seen that it affects it even more than ICP-OS. So if you have your standards in 1% nitric acid, it's completely different to if you have them in 2% nitric acid. You will see maybe 10%, 20% difference in the signal. So that's quite high difference. So matrix matching is very important. And purity is one of those issues. When we analyze concentrations that get lower and lower, purity becomes very important. And when we're talking about analytical chemistry, you will find a term, contamination. Maybe I've already spoken about this, but the contamination issues are very, very important in ICP-MS, especially because we are analyzing even lower concentrations. And the contamination means that we can introduce the analyte into our samples for calibration standards, even though we don't mean to do that. So that's what contamination is. So analyte will, we will contaminate our samples and calibration standards with the analyte if we are not very strict with our purity measures. And sources of contamination. So if we add into our sample, so we have some kind of pretreatment of the sample, we add some reagents, they need to be of high purity. Then we have maybe our samples are in some kind of containers. We need to make sure that the analyte is not present in our containers. Analytical equipment, so our pipettes need to be in good condition and pure. Laboratory facilities, so even our tabletops, if you have some dust on your tabletops, that can cause contamination, and even the laboratory staff itself. So we ourselves can, our fingers are filled with sodium, other elements, and if we have some makeup, that can drop into our samples and so on. So, and hair products, that's an also, and also jewelry. So when we are wearing jewelry, that could contaminate our samples. And this depends on how low concentrations you will analyze and what elements, of course. If you're analyzing, let's say, very weird elements that are not present in everyday systems, maybe tantalum, I presume it's not present in our tabletop dusts or anything like that, or makeup or other stuff that we have commonly in our daily life. But for instance, difficult elements are iron, calcium, calcium, silicon. Silicon here, phosphorus. Yeah, maybe nickel present in jewelry. Then titanium, where is my titanium? There. So titanium dioxide present in most makeups, chemicals, and so on. So those are examples of the elements that have difficult contamination issues. So if you want to analyze very low concentrations of iron, or titanium, for instance, you will have to be very strict on this contamination issue. How to avoid the contamination? So we, of course, want to avoid this contaminating our stuff in the laboratories. One possibility is that we have a separate sample handling laboratory with a dedicated balance and automated pipettes. So we have where our ICP-MS stuff is prepared. That's different to the one where we are weighing, for instance, some kind of ash samples or some kind of solid samples which have formed dust and can get into our samples. So if you have the possibility of having a separate laboratory where you prepare ICP-MS standards and samples, that would be ideal. So when you're moving into the very low concentrations, have a separate system. Always this is not the case, but at least the purity of the balance is important. So if you weigh your samples, your liquid samples, which you are analyzing with ICP-MS, if you put them into the balance should be clean and so on. And the automated pipettes would need to be using a different automated pipette. We actually saw this when we were analyzing nanoparticles. We saw some contamination issues when we were using the same automated pipettes or micro pipettes. Wow, because we had people doing like recovery tests with high gold concentration solutions, like PCBs, printed circuit boards, which could have high gold concentration, and they had like 1,000 ppm of gold. And then at the same time, we were trying to analyze nanoparticles in the low nanograms per liter range. So that was basically impossible. So that's why we put the two different how to say, two different into two different laboratories. So the high concentration gold work was done in a different laboratory, and the low concentration ICP-MS work was done in a different laboratory. So that's one way to avoid this. Then we have seen that using new plastic tube for calibration solutions and samples can sometimes be beneficial. So usually we use wash ones, but sometimes it's not enough, so we need to have new metal-free plastic tubes where we have the samples in, so the containers. Then you could acid wash your plasma. This is what we have done with when we analyzed mercury. So we had very, in this case, we were below nanograms per liter. So the detection limit was, so is it high picogram? Less than nanograms, the next one picogram. Yeah. So we were at the picogram per liter range. And when we were taking the samples, we were taking natural water samples from rivers and lakes. We had these 1 liter glass bottles, which need to be brown for mercury analysis. So we took them, and it was like a, I think it was 10% of hydrochloric acid washing, and then keeping those containers or those glassware in that hydrochloric acid for 24 hours, and then washing with ultra pure water. And it's quite a tedious system to do, but it was necessary for the mercury analysis. And then you could take the water sample from the river just to make sure that you're not contaminating your water sample with the actual glassware, actual glass bottle you are taking the sample into. Ultra pure acids we use with ICP-MS. Ultra pure acids, they are of course a little bit more expensive, but needed especially for those common elements, so iron, calcium. Yeah, of course the alkaline metals, of course, sodium, that's the worst, I think that's the most problematic potassium element. So they are present in those not so pure acids, so ultra pure acids is the way to go with ICP-MS. Yeah, and then we noticed that jewelry and cosmetics caused problems when we were doing this nanoparticle analysis in the nanogram per liter range, so no jewelry or cosmetics was used when we did those analyses. You could tell that the person was going to do nanoparticle analysis if she wore nothing, nothing at all. Oh, of course, closed. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to delete this from the record. Moving on. Then tuning protocols in the ICP-MS. This is more closely monitored, the daily performance of the ICP-MS with compared to ICP-OS. So ICP-MS, everything affects everything. So that's a quite a difficult instrument in that case. So ICP-OS, very straightforward, analyze and go. But ICP-MS, every change in one parameter affects each other. So we need to take care of the daily performance. And it could be that the day before you analyze everything with no problems, but the next day you will have some kind of problem arising, maybe because of your previous measurements or something else. But with ICP-MS, we have this tuning protocols. In Finnish, maybe it's like säädöt, päivittäiset säädöt, tuning. I don't know if that's, that is it used in other purposes, but tuning is what it's called in English. We have a daily tuning check. Compared to ICP-OS, you go in, you check the sample introduction is working, and then you calibrate, and basically it. You check that there is no blockage. But with ICP-MS, you always do a daily tuning check. So we have, I was supposed to have a screenshot from our instrument, but I do not. But there is a specific solution that we analyze. It has low concentrations of some elements. We check their intensity, and if there is some kind of limit, so the indium concentration or the indium count intensity needs to be higher than 30,000 counts, for instance. There is, I think, five checks that it runs, and if they are all passed, we just run our analysis and go. But if it's not passed, we need to adjust the parameters. And first, there is a nebulizer gas flow adjustment, there is a plasma alignment adjustment, and then the ion optics. And basically, you don't need to very carefully do anything by hand, but it's just clicking on adjust nebulizer gas flow button, actually. You just need to know, check the results that come out. You don't need to do anything very difficult. And the aim here is to maximize the signal, but minimize our interferences that arise from the doubly charged ions and oxides. So in ICP-MS, we don't like doubly charged ions or oxides because they cause overlap in the spectra and interferences in our analysis. And this tuning protocol is to minimize those, but at the same time maximize the signal. And some kind of compromise is always found. In practice, the adjustments are very automated, but of course the user must know what they are doing. So if you get some kind of weird results, you can see it if you know what you are doing. We can check these at the ICP-MS demonstration more closely, how the tuning is done. So we will tune the instrument then. Yeah, as I mentioned, if you change one parameter, it will change all the others. And this will require more expertise from the user than with ICP-OS. So it might be because you have these three different optimizations here, so nebulizer gas flow, plasma alignment, and ion optics, you might need to do them several times to get them right. So if this changes a lot, you might need to do this and go back here and start again until you pass the check. So that's how we do it. So we change these parameters and run the optimizations, and then when we do the check, it passed, and then we can continue on with our analysis. Yeah. And then with ICP-MS, we have two analysis options. The first is a scan. So if we are interested in seeing the scan of the whole sample, we can do a scan of the desired mass to charge, maybe choose some kind of, maybe not the whole mass range, but maybe some kind of from 50 to 100 or something like this. This is especially useful if you are worried about interferences and you would like to see what is causing me maybe some kind of interference in my analysis. This is what it looks like. So it's just analyzing, scanning the spectrum. It could look like this is quite a short scan here, but it could look like, sorry about that. Scanning something like this. Okay, I'm gonna stop this. 50 to 100. Maybe something like this. So scanning the spectrum. But standard analysis are usually performed using peak hopping method. And this is done by applying a certain voltage to the quadrupole. This we usually use the quadrupole, and then we wait a settling time, and then we collect the signal, which is called a dwell time. And this is repeated for all the mass-to-charge ratios which we want to analyze. So it basically means if we have, take the difference. Maybe I want to analyze here 52. I don't know if anything's there. 53. If I wanted to analyze all of these, it will change the voltage to 52, then hop onto the next 53 and change the voltage and do it like this. So it hops to a different mass. Always changing the voltage so it's specific to a specific mass to charge ratio. We're hopping to a different amperage value and then collecting the signal during the dwell time. And this can be done this can be done several times. So if you do it sweep, if you sweep the mass range for several times, you will get more signal. So this is why we have usually several sweeps. So when it's done here, I would have this kind of mass range. It goes back and does a second sweep of the mass range. So you are always, as you do several sweeps, you are increasing the signal that you are getting. This is very pretty much the same kind of image. So it scans one mass, collects the signal here, scans, collects the signal, scans, collects the signals, and then goes back and does several sweeps. If you come across a term integration time, it's like a total time collecting the signal. If you have like 10 sweeps, you will multiply the time of the single sweep with the number of sweeps to get the integration time. So if you would collect one signal for five seconds, I don't know if that's anything realistic. No, it's like milliseconds, I think. I have it here. Oh, no, I don't. Yeah, it's like a milliseconds, 5 milliseconds, which is collects the signal, and then you would have 10 sweeps, so you would have 500 milliseconds of the integration time. Yeah, but as this is so here I'm talking about the quadruple, so this doesn't apply to other detector or other mass separation devices, of course, because this is about the quadrupole, which does this sequentially. So this is about the quadrupole mass separate only. Then choosing the measurement conditions, how many points per peak? It's usually we use only 1 point per peak for best detection limits, and that's because we have the highest intensity here. So we choose one peak here. If we take several peaks here, we will get the sides of the peaks also into our signal, and that's where most of the unreliability. Do I have uncertainty? Okay, uncertainty. So the sides of the peak have the highest uncertainty. So if you're measuring directly from the highest intensity, that will cause you the best results and best detection limits. Settling time. We use a settling time when we change the voltage of the quadrupole. So we use a settling time. So the instrument like stabilizes, you could say. So we are stabilizing the instrument, short settling time there before we collect the signal. Dwell time is how much we collect the signal. Okay, for 50 milliseconds is usually used. So this is the time we collect the signal. If you have a very low concentration, you could increase this dwell time. So you could use, I don't know which is realistic, but this of course will cause you to have a longer analysis. So if you have time and very low concentrations, you can increase the dwell time to get more better detection limits. And sweeps, this will increase if you have more sweeps, this will improve your data quality and detection limits, so you will get more reproducible results. Here you can see a scan sweep. So this is one scan done here, and then a second sweep is done, and you're collecting more data with each sweep. So here's three sweeps done. So this will improve. But of course, more sweeps you do, the longer your analysis will be. Yeah, integration time, 1 to 7 seconds for best detection limits. So this is basically dwell time times the sweep times. Yeah. But if you're analyzing isotopic ratios, you could use even like 5 to 10 minutes. So that will cause you to have quite a long analysis if you are doing isotope ratios. But this is where you need to be quite specific to get the ratios correct. So that's why you could use very long analysis time for the isotope ratio determination. We have actually never done that. We haven't needed that, but many laboratories do that if they have some requirement for that, maybe for biological or some kind of radio, like decay of some kind of isotope. I don't know. Yeah, maybe multiple applications available, but we haven't used that. Okay, then I have one example for you. You can think about it a little bit, and then we can look at it together. And then I only have one example after that about, let's take a look at the ICP-NS method, what it actually looks like for a sewage sludge sample. But let's take a look at this first. So I have a here, yeah, we will go free on time because this is my one example and then about the method, quite short. So 0.5 grams of the sample, we add 7 milliliters of nitric acid, 3 milliliters of hydrochloric acid, and dilute to 50 milliliters with ultra-pure water. And rare earth element concentrations are from 20 to 5,000 micrograms per liter. So rare earth elements over here from lanthanum to lutetium, the group of 18 elements. So those are the analytes we want to analyze. Then matrix elements are present. Iron is present in 500 milligrams per liter. And the question is, what would be an appropriate dilution for these samples for an ICP-NS analysis? The analytes are the rare earth elements. Calculate the total dissolved solids from here. So the sample mass and the final volume and the acidity. So consider the nitric and hydrochloric acid concentrations. And also note the iron concentration here. So this is of the transition elements that have value. So you can consider this. We will take continue at 11, so you have a little bit over 5 minutes to consider this, and we will continue. Okay, now we can take a look at what you were thinking for this problem. What did you, what kind of dilution were you thinking about for these concerns? At least 50. Yeah. How much do we have? Yeah. Yes, I think that would be sufficient. So it's not worth. Okay, we have total dissolved solids of 1%. So if you divide that by 50, you would be very safely in the good range. Acidity 20%. Yeah, that's also fine. So 50 would be quite okay. I think I have put in here 100-fold. You would even do 100-fold dilution. So you need to consider these. So you get these below the maximum limits. The rare earth elements are very sensitive, so you could do even 100-fold dilution. In that case, your sample concentrations would be from 0.2 to 50 micrograms per liter. Yeah, and if you did a 50-fold dilution, your maximum concentration would be 100 micrograms per liter. I don't think that would be too high, but yeah. And the iron would be, if you did a 100-fold dilution, the iron would be in an okay level at 5 milligrams per liter. So for ICP-MS, you always need to consider if you have dissolved the solid samples, in most cases you will have to do a dilution of maybe 1500 fold, depending on your sample. You could even have, I have a case, actually that's the case that we will analyze in the ICP-MS demonstration. I have quail samples. So Viiliäinen, it's a bird. A bird that has, it's from the environmental sciences. The bird's tissue has been dissolved, and then we are analyzing lead. Lead is the analyte. But for that case, the lead concentration is so low that we don't need to. I think the dilution was purely based on the acid content, so we have 10% of acid in our samples. We're doing a 5-fold dilution to get the acid into tolerable 2% range. But yes, this is what we need to consider when we are planning the analysis. Then I just wanted to show you the ICP-MS method. We will probably don't have. We will take a look at the demonstrations also, but here we can at least maybe you can see better because the room is a little bit crowded, so maybe you won't see the method so closely. This is a method for sewage sludge samples. Yeah, it's for the same. No, this is for what was for ash samples, sorry. Ash samples, but here I'm analyzing the rare earth elements from sewage sludge from the waste water treatment plant. And here's a part of the analysis list, analyte list. So not all of the analytes are actually here. Couldn't fit them into my screen because there are 18 of them, and if I have several isotopes, the list is long, so I cut it. But this is what it looks like. We have the timing tab here. So we have 20 sweeps. I talked about the sweep. So how many times we are sweeping the mass range. We are having three replicates. So the instrument is analyzing three replicates. The total analysis time is 1 minute 30 seconds for each sample, so it estimates it here, and the analytes are shown here. We have two analytes, scandium and yttrium, here, which have lower atomic mass or the mass-to-charge ratio than the other elements. So lanthanum starting from 138 here, so it has a considerably higher mass. So we are using a different internal standard for this scandium and yttrium. So we are using beryllium. So it has a mass of 9. It's not actually optimal, I would say, beryllium, because it's so low in mass, but I think we haven't found anything other suitable than beryllium for these lower mass analytes. For the higher mass analytes, we are using indium as an internal standard, so it has a mass of 115. So it's suitable for these guys over here. Then something else, maybe 12 time we discussed, so 50 milliseconds. Here is used for the 12 time, so how long we are collecting the signal. Here is the mode that might be interesting, is the standard mode. So if we used some interference removal technique, we would use other modes, so we can select it here. So if you still remember when I talked about the kinetic helium mode, let's say short, kinetic energy discrimination. So the collision mode, helium mode, we can select it here. So we can collide our analytes and interferences with the helium gas and get rid of some of the large interference species, so molecular species. Then we can also use reaction mode. So we put in some kind of gas in the system and we make reactions. Not all of the instruments have this collision or reaction mode, but we do. I think most of the instruments nowadays have this collision and reaction mode. Yeah, but you can change this here if you want to use the reaction or collision mode. And here you put in the gas flow rate. So it's quite simple. Then processing tab. Nothing very interesting here. We don't even change this, so I'm gonna actually skip it. The equations. This is quite interesting. So the instrument does automated corrections for some elements. As you can see for indium, which is our internal standard, this is the equation it uses to correct indium signal. So it has a tin interference with the mass that has been selected here. So 150 is interfered by tin. So it's measuring tin at the different mass and then subtracting its contribution from the indium signal. And where you can see the correction equation, it's using that, and where there's nothing, there's no interference, that it can be correcting. So if there's interference, it's not correcting. But for these, you can see the equations here. If you know better than the instruments, you could even change these equations. So change this little bit if you wanted to, or add some kind of different element that you are subtracting from the signal. But you need to be, of course, careful with this, because you can get any kinds of results if you make mistake in this. And here you can see the potential interferences. These are the potential interferences, oxides. Here's some doubly charged species, carbon dioxide, barium dioxide. Here's some doubly charged species, zirconium plus two, Why is twice when I don't know. Maybe it's so difficult to put it twice. Okay. Then for the calibration, you will put in, maybe you looked at the calibration methods tab in the ICP OS demonstration, or maybe you didn't, but you will put into the method your calibration range. And because I have several analytes with different calibration ranges, I have to be very careful when I put this here. And the unit is ppb, so micrograms per liter. I have a concentration in the standards of 0.05 micrograms per liter. Then I have 0.1 and 1 microgram per liter. For the lower range, this is my lower range. Then I have some elements in higher concentrations. They are up to 100 micrograms per liter. But you need to be careful when you put this. If you have in the same method elements that have different calibration ranges, be careful when you put this into the method. Then we have a sampling tab. We have a specific system here at JYU, which we are using an automated dilution system. So actually the autosampler that we have can do dilution for us, so we don't actually have to do the dilutions by hand. So here is the dilution factor that we can use for our samples. So if we have concentrated samples, we can put them into the autosampler and just tell the autosampler to dilute them 100-fold. So that's a really nice system. Another advantage of that kind of system is that it actually dilutes our standards for us, calibration standards. So we don't have to prepare maybe one or two intermediate solutions that it can get dilute from. So it does the calibration curve for us. We just need to tell it how to dilute our samples and calibration standards. So the solutions I actually need here is a blank. I have it in position one. So this is the solution ID. So it tells which solution I'm analyzing. So blank is the first one. It's in autosampler location one. Then I have prepared by hand a standard with 1 microgram per liter concentration. It's in location two. And then from this, the autosampler is actually diluting the other solutions, and from this also. So I have two standards that I prepare by hand, and the other solutions are prepared by the autosampler. So this calibration has five standards here. Yeah, and then internal standard, our automated dilution system also adds that into every sample that is analyzed, so you don't have to do that by hand. So it's a very, very nice system, although expensive. Expensive one, so not all of the laboratories, actually very rare. It's very quite rare to have that kind of system, but we were lucky to have some good project money from the EU at that time, so we got the automated dilution system. But the maximum dilution factor is 400, so you couldn't do it. You couldn't put in your stock solution of 1,000 milligrams per liter and say, I want 5 nanograms. So it cannot do such high dilution factor. So that's why I have prepared these by hand from the standards of the stock solutions. So, but it makes life a lot easier. Yeah. Then report doesn't have very, very much important stuff here. I'm going to skip it. Then notes. This is an important one. So when you're having a method and you make changes, maybe you change the internal standards, change the calibration range, it's nice to write them down somewhere. And this is a good place because next time you will come, you won't remember what you have changed. So I have written What kind of asset background I have, what kind of internal standards I have, what are their concentrations when I prepare them, and what kind of dilution factor, and the dates when I have made changes. So this is a nice thing to report in your method, or if you don't have this in your method, maybe write them down in some kind of lab book or anything so you know what you are doing. Yeah, that's about it, the ICP-MS method. Thank you. So this was the last lecture. We will see you on Thursday with the exercises. But if you have any questions, would like to answer, of course. Otherwise, Radikaali is having some kind of arts and crafts and snacks kind of thing there, so you can make your own keychain using some nice beads and stuff. So maybe check it out.